Soy Power Podcast is a free podcast made possible by the support of our awesome Patreon sponsors. Head to toypowerpodcast.com and see how you can help.
Oh yeah, this is power.
Hello and welcome to Toy Power, the show that we talk toys and everything pop culture. I'm Trent and excellent to have your company today for episode
71.
This week on Toy Power, we take a look at the Netflix show season 2 of The Toys That Made Us. We then hit up our vintage toy line retrospective on a fan-requested topic, which is going to be Zoids. Joining me today in the Toy Power studio, we've got Darren.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us.
Ben.
G'day, g'day.
And Frank.
Hoi, hoi.
And season 2 of Toys That Made Us is now on Netflix. 4 episodes.
Yep.
On the 8-part documentary series.
You have to change the theme song now.
Yeah, I have a weird feeling that season 1 was intended to be 8 episodes. Mm. And somewhere along the line, it's been condensed into 4. And these 4, from all the reports that I read, these were all shot
at the same time.
The same time, pretty much ready to go. I know they were still maybe doing some post-production or some editing on the latter 4.
Mm.
But I never thought this was going to come out as a season 2.
I thought it was a season 1.5, and we spoke in another episode that they've, and it's actually from the Toys That Made Us official page. I said we were renewed for season 3, which by extension of that means that these 4 we're talking about is season 2.
It
but
is, yeah.
I agree, when you've got a theme song that states it's an 8-part series and this is the second 4 of those 8, is it season 2?
It is now officially.
Yeah.
It's almost,
two,
I see it more in season 1 volume 2. But
oh, yeah. That's a good way of looking at it.
Yeah.
Cool.
But anyway, so toy lines that we got to in these 4 episodes, we had Star Trek, Transformers, which was brilliant, Hello Kitty, and remind me of the 4th.
Lego,
of course. So maybe we'll just start from the top. So we'll start with Star Trek. What did we think?
Look, I'm more Trekkie than I am a Star Wars person. So I love this, to be honest. 10 minutes after I watched it, I was on eBay looking at all the Playmates figures. I never realized that the original run of Playmates figures ran for so long. Seen a few of them, obviously, in Trent's collection. The fascinating bit for me was all the old school stuff, all the stuff that our parents would have seen in the stores, and it was quite literally, Star Trek's popular. Here's a hammer. Let's put a Star Trek logo on it. It's a Star Trek space hammer. All that sort of stuff was just a really interesting look back at just how licensing arguably began, really. So that was very, very cool. And even the going when they sort of flash forward to the modern stuff, there was a point where they had, and I think it was a NECA or maybe the Diamond Select figure of Kirk, vintage Kirk, is alongside of Picard. And my wife went, that's amazing. Like, that looks genuinely dead set, like, you know, Patrick Stewart and, you know, what's Kirk's name again?
William Shatner.
That's the one. Thank you.
I learned something from that Art Asylum, which I knew was doing those Trek figures back in the day, went on to become Diamond Select Toys. So it is, they are one and the same.
Right.
So Art Asylom is now
Diamond Select Toys.
And yeah, that had a massive run.
Mm.
I remember seeing them at retail, but I never knew it went that deep, which was really nice. It's now the master license is sitting with McFarlane.
Oh,
and we
right.
did see, I think at the last big con, Picard and the Captain Kirk versions, which are going to be great. Yeah, for me, this had a lot of the history. And part of it, the first part I see, Frank, as you said, was the sticker, put a sticker on it. And they did that little scene at the start where they recreate the production line of, you know, now we're sticking this on it because it's Star Trek.
Yep.
And there were some really wacky things that were produced.
The police siren.
The police
siren.
Was
by far the worst.
Yeah, so that was fascinating. Like the army set where it was army men.
Oh, yes.
Like
yeah.
Army men and these sort of alien things.
Yeah.
Like to actually just rebadge that, it's just so lazy. Yeah. It's just, and you can really feel for the fans to say, look, I love this show and it's such a deep show that I'm into. And this is what you're giving me as the merchandising. Mm. Like, I'm not stupid. Yeah. I know that's not Spock and Kirk. That's like an army man with a rifle. Like, what do you want me to do with that?
I find that fascinating, partly because it's so early on, I guess, in the history of licensing. So, on one hand, I totally get what you're saying about feeling for the fans, Trent, but then on the other side of that, I kind of think there's probably not much else around at that time. So, maybe Batman 66 to sort of go, well, you know, what's the benchmark?
What's on offer? Yeah.
You know,
oh, exactly. Yep.
You know, so I think you probably could get away with it. Well, you wouldn't get away with it now, but you could definitely get away with it a lot more back then because licensing was such a, you know, new
concept. Yeah.
So I find that fascinating, just seeing that play out. And as you all know, my late grandfather worked at John Martin's. So seeing all the stuff from the 1960s made me think, you know, was he asked for that? Was he asked for this item over there? Did someone in their mind believe that that was him that gave it to them if they've got it? You know, those sort of things I found fascinating, just sort of seeing that unpack. And I'm not the biggest Star Trek fan in the room, but I appreciate it for what it is and have warm memories of seeing the Galoob Star Trek figures at Woolworths Variety in Rundle Mall back in 1987, I believe, or 88. And also the Playmates Star Trek figures that Trent's got. Mm. I remember seeing them at Big W for a lot of years because that line ran for so long and ran deep. So for me, it was just fascinating seeing all this stuff and the background sets, you know, whether we're talking comic shops or collector shops or whatever, just seeing all these Minton card figures from different lines, Toy Biz, X-Men, you know, some Batman animated series stuff. You know, really fascinating. Just sort of seeing that. You know, definitely worth pausing to get a good look at it all.
Without a doubt, yeah. I think Gene Roddenberry here was very quick to just license anything and didn't really care, I guess, what quality of product was coming out. And that's obviously something people have learnt from, to be very careful with what you do license and how you go about it and how you ensure quality control.
I thought it was really cool in the sense they gave really good background history on how the franchise went from the film point of view, like you know how they thought, oh, this one's going to be the biggest film, and then it flopped. Like it was just a whole lot of nothing.
Yeah, no toys for Wrath of Khan.
Which is arguably one of the best ones.
Yeah.
Because of the previous movie was so bad. Yeah. Like they put so much money into doing. Anyway, go and watch it. But too much Star Wars. Too much reference to Star Wars.
I agree, 100%.
You know, you've already done Star Wars. Leave it alone. Like, just drop it. And that's where I think the Toys That Made Us needs to find their sort of evenness of it's a documentary or it's a comedy. Like, don't try and make
I thought that joke had its place the first time.
Correct.
At the very beginning of the episode, that had its place.
Yeah, because the two are linked.
Because Star Wars is such a big pop cultural thing and a big part of toys, had its place once. When you start thinking that it's a 50-minute documentary and you're counting it multiple times, to the point where maybe it might even go into your second hand, you start to think, well, not only is this no longer funny, but I'm predicting when you're next going
to... 100% agree it needed to be said. But as you said, Darren, not seven times.
Exactly.
Throughout the... Not reminded time and time again.
Mm.
Yeah. Anyway, anything else for this one or shall we move?
Just quickly, the Mego story was really cool in this.
Yeah.
So to hear about... I guess you heard a bit about some sort of shoddy practices that may have been part of the
demise
of Mego. But just to hear, again, like this is a... You know, how Mego was picking up superheroes... You know, you can almost attribute Mego to bringing back superheroes into the mainstream in a way.
Really took them from, I guess, the Action Man concept of the 1960s, which was how a lot of superheroes were, I guess, put out in figure form. You buy the suit for your Action Man and turn him into Superman or Batman or you know, for is it Action Boy or Action Lad, you buy the Robin suit, that sort of thing. this actually took it to, no, Batman's going to be a figure, Superman's going to be a figure, they're not going to be close that someone else's figure wears. You're going to get a Joker figure, that sort of thing. So Mego really took the superhero concept for an action figure line and made it happen. And also gave us one of the few offerings of DC and Marvel residing in the one line.
Yep. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. Very good. Okay, we'll move on to Transformers. Got wood?
Oh man, I was redwood, like yeah. That was like a lot of the Transformers lore is common knowledge to a lot of us, and we've even covered it on one of our previous episodes, but I honestly did not ever imagine that those guys, the Japanese, carved all those pre-figures out of wood.
Yeah, and, insane.
And built them up and to pretty much transform. And I'm not just talking about just, okay, there's a blank piece of square wood and that's going to be his head. Like, they had carved the details of Optimus Prime. Yep. Right down to the faceplate, you know, mouthpiece and everything. Like, it was insane. And that... going to that depth is like those little wooden figures would be priceless.
Yeah, part of history.
Oh, it's incredible. Yeah. Insane. Really liked them. They did cover on all the other companies that Hasbro pulled from to bring, you know, characters like Jetfire, Mega Supreme, the Deluxe Insecticons, you know, all those other companies. So they did touch on that, which I thought was really cool. And just going to the Marvel studio and saying, right, you've got 48 hours to, you know, write 72 bios and come up with names. This is what they look like. You know, close the door, see you later, good luck.
Imagine being that guy who, you know, in the space of 2 days, you've given a name to a character like Starscream and basically set him on the path for the character that everyone, whatever iteration that he is, this scheming, backstabbing, you know, second in command kind of thing. That was amazing. Well done.
Really interesting. Mm. Really enjoyed it. Areas I felt they lacked on, they talked about... the evolution of Master Transformers and coming into the Bayverse movies and things, which is kind of cool, but it completely skipped over Alternators, which I thought was a big turning point for between the these Transformers are for kids and this is now
for adults,
based on and like pretty much an actual car. You could have that model car there and fool people into thinking that's just a model car. Like, they are so well done. So definitely miss that, and I think they should have done a lot more of their little bit more spotlight definitely on Masterpiece, because that's the next degree of adult collecting and bringing a whole new generation of adult collectors back into Transformers.
Agree. There was an entire couple of generations. I was glad to see that touched on Beast Wars. I kind of feared that would just get left by the wayside and they go straight from G1 to Michael Bay, but I was glad that got a shout out because that kind of saved them from the brink of the franchise disappearing altogether. But there was an entire couple of, well, I want to say close to a decade worth of toys before you get to Michael Bay that they just sort of glossed over. And you're right, Alternators and Masterpiece were probably the two to shout out. You could probably skip a lot of Energon and those sorts of series. But yeah, overall, I loved it. And as Ben said, a lot of the stuff I already knew, but seeing those wooden carvings of Soundwave's head and stuff, I was like, oh my god, that's amazing. And it was really interesting hearing the things from the Japanese point of view, where they were initially quite apprehensive and nervous about this big American company coming in and taking their ideas and how it was all going to work. And I think at one point he even said, look, I think he saw part of the early cartoon, he's like, I'm not a fan.
Why is Megatron so small in gun form, but then so big? What's with this size displacement device
exactly
that he has?
Mass shifting,
But that is literally because they're just drawing these from... I think they came from both the Takara products, but they were from separate lines. So you had almost the ones that would transform into vehicles, and then you had the ones that would transform into household into items, like cassette players and microscopes and cameras and all that. And they just meshed it all together.
They just threw a line down the middle and said, right, cars go on either good guys, everything else is bad guys. And that was series one, you know, essentially. Absolutely. And for a lot of it, that was the baseline of their you know, structure. Mm. And yeah.
But how good, and we talked about it, but Bob Budiansky with his bios, but just the ability to kind of go to Marvel and for someone to produce something that holds up today, those characters, those names.
Those like, comic books, still, you read them today, they are sensational. Yeah. I mean, you get past about issue 30 or something and they start pumping in the characters.
Yeah,
and
new ones.
There's toys out on the shelf that we haven't even talked about in the comic books yet, so they started to rush it after that. But you know, Transformers comics was only meant to be a four-part issue series. Mm. And then on the fifth cover, it's got Shockwave, you know, till all are dead.
Yeah, nice.
Optimus Prime is headless. Like, you know, Optimus Prime wasn't even the focus character. It was the other characters, you know, trying to save Optimus. It's just, it's an amazing storyline. Yeah. Like, if you guys are listening and you haven't read it, you know, pick them up. There's plenty of reissues out there and omnibus books and things that combine. I'm sure you can look up on the internet as well, download them and stuff, but it's definitely a cool story line to just, you know, grab the first few dozen issues, and it's a really, really cool storyline.
Agreed, so. Yeah.
The bit that I kind of never joined in my head that they put on paper and kind of said was when Takara came out of the equation and stopped sort of supporting the US, and then you saw what it turned into. And I think this is sort of the era where you had Pretenders and things
because they were trying to tap into the
Action
G.I. Joe market.
Yeah, maybe as well, and I don't know if it's sort of alluded to, but the fact they didn't have the ability to make talent. These really complex transforming toys. Mm. So they went back to simpler transformations. And like you said,
and it was the demise of the line.
And it was, and really it only went gangbusters again. Was it sort of back to
Beast Wars?
Yeah, where they got Takara back in and really leveraged off that ingenuity. And just to see the name of the Japanese designer, Hideaki Yuki, who at the end was presented with that beautiful Perceptor, because they called him Perceptor. And but just the mind that can take an object and turn it into a robot, and particularly what they do now on Masterpiece. That is just
engineering stunning level.
That's so why when it comes to like spending money on toys, I have no qualms about when a Masterpiece comes out and it's, for argument's sake, $300, and people go, how can you spend that much on a toy? I said, because it would have taken a team of engineers years to make this happen. I have no qualms in doing that, and you look at what it can do, and it's just, it's a marvel of creation, really.
I've always, Frank and I had this conversation on the way over here today, actually, always associated Transformers Masterpiece with Transformers, you know, Hot Toys for Transformers, basically, Sideshow for Transformers, that sort of quality.
That level.
You expect a similar sort of price tag for something of that sort of standard, and I think, you know, that just flies through. But, I mean, they are, for anyone who's never seen one, there probably aren't too many listeners to us, but that haven't. But for anyone that hasn't, a Transformers Masterpiece really is something to behold. Mm.
And I think we touched on the humour, the use of humour in the Star Trek episode. I felt like the Transformers were, there were still elements of that, but I felt like it was treated with much more reverence and respect.
Agreed.
Particularly at the end when there was that sort of focus on Prime and they had a chat to Peter Cullen and this sort of stuff. There was no jokes about, oh, did you know Peter Cullen also did this silly voice? Yeah. And it was just like, nah, this is a property that is loved internationally, and we're gonna give it the reference.
Well,
that
exactly,
and that was actually quite touching, the way Peter Cullen talks about his brother, who was in the armed forces as well. And I didn't quite get the full story on that, but obviously that was very personal to him to talk about. The other thing that this, I don't know, what are your guys' feelings in the room on this, which is the death of Optimus Prime? And if you think about that movie, and you think about when it happened, as Ben said, they're trying to clear out those G1 characters and bring in, you know, Rodimus Prime and Ultra Magnus and do all of that stuff. But the impact it had on those kids, they're, like, I loved it. I'm just like, this is so cool. This is what you want to do. But I'm feel like I'm the only kid that kind of had that response.
It didn't faze me. Like, it's not something I remember. Like, oh my gosh, I lapped it up in the sense that, oh, cool, this is mature. Yep. I'm seeing a gritty side of the Transformers I have otherwise never seen before, and I lapped that up. Maybe that's, you know, part of why I'm a bit of a horror fan and things. But
that's why you love Decepticons, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, finally,
basically,
you know,
it was a happy ending for you. Well, yeah,
but you know, and like seeing you know, Megatron was cool, but seeing Galvatron, like, he just didn't like, Starscream gets up and, like, I'm going to do, see you later, you know.
Two ashes,
like, this is so cool. So I didn't take it to heart like some people did, but, you know, I've heard plenty of stories where mums were taking their crying kids out of the cinema and, you know, hundreds of thousands of fan mails going to Hasbro, you've killed...
You can't do this.
Yeah, you've killed... And they even said it, I think, in the final credits of the film, like, Optimus Prime will be back.
Yeah.
But the damage is already done. Like, and that's why they rewrote the G.I. Joe movie to have... is it Duke? Come, he survives. The,
The same response.
Well, no, they didn't want that response.
Okay.
Because that was a direct... you know, follow through because they didn't want the Optimus Prime.
They didn't
Prime.
Want angry parents.
Yeah. They didn't want G.I. Joe fanboy kids having, you know, having the same throwback at them.
I remember when I first saw it, because I saw it just on the TV guide that it was on. I didn't know about the Transformers movie. I was, you know, quite shocked at the content. I was okay with it. I was older. I was okay with it, but I was quite shocked because it was so gritty and different from Transformers, as Ben said. It did disturb me to see some of my childhood heroes just wiped away and, you know, cast aside as trash or cannon fodder just because that was the story point. But I could also see the toy commercial sense to it at that age as well, that, you know, they were trying to sell new product.
Yeah, I took it as like it's a war, right? It's a war between the Autobots and Decepticons. There's always going to be casualty. Now, Prime, I perhaps didn't mind as much, and he got that epic fight scene. It wasn't just a bang, you're dead that happened to a number of the other Autobots, right?
Yep.
And I think that was I think the only thing that possibly might have softened it a bit is if you saw some Decepticons actually get destroyed, which you sort of do,
you do.
When they become the sweeps and the Armada and all that sort of stuff.
I still function.
Yeah, that sort of stuff. So, look, I a bit like Ben, I don't remember it having an impact on me as a kid. I think of all the it was risky. It was chancy for them to do that in an era when heroes don't die. They always save the day. And
4 billion year old war, and I'm still alive.
Exactly. And the meme that was floating around sort of post Infinity War, when everyone's like, oh, you think your kids are upset seeing the end of Infinity War? They know nothing of true heartache, and there's a grey Optimus Prime on the table.
Agreed.
Yeah, very good. All right, awesome. Lego, or Lego, as you may pronounce it. Again, we've probably had a few documentaries in this space, and there's been some really good ones. But I learned some new things watching this documentary. The first being the fact that Bionicle was kind of a savior for Lego.
It wasn't that interesting.
Which is kind of... And it's so non-Lego in a way, because it doesn't fit the system.
And so many efforts to bring the line back and just complete failures. And just then, you know, Bionicle was the one. Like, who would have thought? I remember seeing Bionicle. I never had any interest in it.
Well, it was sort of, for us, it was... We would have been a bit older when that
I got big into this. I've got the first, like, three waves all complete and stuff. And I pulled it out at a trade day and tried to talk to some of the Lego guys, like Steve Reddy and Luke and these guys. And they were just like, let me tell you a little story about Bionicles. If you're a quote-unquote true Lego fan, you hate Bionicles. Like, it's really viewed by the purists as, and they do touch on this in the episode, it's viewed by the purists as, nah, it's bad.
It's not part of the model or whatever.
It doesn't fit the system. And yet to hear that, hey, this kind of saved the brand as you know it, I think it deserves a little bit more respect than that, but I do understand where these guys are coming from.
The one thing I loved, because this was really a family business, and it probably still is a family business, and it's passed on from the founding member to the son, and then he passes it on to his grandson. But it was that the first son was fighting so hard with his father to get the color green.
Yes.
It's like, there's no green. We need green. Yeah. And it was something like 7 years it took him to convince him that they needed a green.
Yeah.
And... like, I just love the fact now we've got so many colours. But that these were massive decisions that they picked. I think it was based on Mondrian's paintings, if you know the artist Mondrian, who did the big canvases with the colours and the hard edge lines, black lines separating them. Might have been a blue and a yellow. They based the original color choice on Mondrian's colors, almost. So that they were just so iconic, and they just didn't change them for years. And then to sort of slowly see these new ideas coming in, like one of the sons or whoever it was said, "Oh, the minifigure. Let's do the minifigure," and it turned into this massive thing. And you know, the green, but just how tough those changes were to make.
I've seen some pretty cool Lego documentaries. Mega Factories is one of them, if you want to see inside the factories. But I just thought it was cool, like, just the, you know, you go and they interview one guy and he's like, "This is the bathroom sink we use to test the boats that float."
And cool,
it's
just
this tiniest little sink, bathroom sink, like, it's probably got someone, you know, right next to the toilet, and they're testing their next future product in that tiny little sink. Like, it's just, it really gave you a perspective of how small the business was and how enormous they've grown. Definitely that was really cool. How important the system is, like, they emphasize that so much. And I don't know if it was an international barrier with language or not, because a lot of, you know, them are German, am I right in saying that? Or
Sweden.
It's from Denmark.
Denmark,
which is actually quite a small country. It doesn't have a big population.
Almost the whole population of that town works for Lego.
They all had a connection.
But anyway, going back, of all the docos, this was the most serious, I found. Okay. I say that because of the language barrier and things like that. There were almost no jokes throughout the whole thing of the documentary, I found. I felt...
out of all the toys that made us
out
shows.
Out of all the shows that we've seen so far. I felt this was the most... The truest to a actual documentary with true facts and left the jokes, you know, to someone else.
A lot of the jokes that I found in this episode were one of the Danish toy designers would explain, you know, "We called it this.
The system."
Yeah, or the system jokes. Or we called it... It had this really big, long name and they kept sort of repeating this name almost. Yeah. And that became Technic Lego or whatever. Yeah. It was changed to call it something else.
Yeah.
And then they'd sort of say, "Well, but this was a brilliant product, but it only got released to schools." You know, and they were sort of, I guess, making jokes of maybe some of the choices they made.
But that came from the people talking, not the editing, not the
producers
and
show.
Things, not by editing it to make it into a joke, not that forced humor.
Yeah, it was literally.
It was just them doing an interview and then putting them on screen, putting jokes into their conversation. Yep. So it was that's the way I looked at it.
For sure.
Just the fact that they put out that electronic system, I can't remember what it's called.
Oh, the Mindstorm.
All the geniuses, you know, took it apart and hacked it and stuff. And instead of them, you know, suing them, they're like, "Well, come and work for us and teach us how to make it better. We can, you know," and improve. That was a true indication of listening to the fans, you know, instead of getting your back up and saying, "Hey, you can't do that. You know, you're making our product better than it actually is." Listening to the fans and then improving on their product for everybody else.
Yeah, very good. All right. And the final episode, which was one...
That was it. That was it. There was only three.
Well, for Osti, we have to shout out Hello Kitty, don't we? We all thought this was a bit of a strange choice. I almost felt... And look, Ossie sort of said the significance of Hello Kitty in Japan is just so massive.
I get Hello Kitty is massive. I really understand, you know, congratulations, Hello Kitty has made a lot of money. It's, you know, a brand that started off nothing and it's spawned 1,000 different other characters. Those happy gay, you know, characters or whatever. But like, you know, my argument is it's a good documentary. Don't get me wrong. But is it a toy documentary? No. It felt more of a merchandise.
Yeah, merchandise. It slap the cute little picture on something. Yes. And then eventually there were plush toys.
And there was a couple of little McDonald's figures that were
there. There was even a shoulder massager.
Yeah, and the...
it was oddly shaped.
The back massager. Yeah. But what I argue is there wasn't a run of toys. This is the action figure line. This is the plush line. It wasn't one thing. It was more, look, we've made, you know, Katy Perry's wearing our underwear now, you know, or it just, I didn't like it for that reason.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I felt the celebrity stuff was weird. It was kind of nice to see that they had that sort of pull now, given that they're in season two. But at the same time, it felt forced, whereas all the other documentaries focused on people who were involved with the brand or created something or voiced something to do with it. These celebrities, and I'm going to shout out Paris Hilton because she was on it far too much, for my opinion. And her answer to, oh, why do you, because it looks cute. Like, that was her take on the whole thing. Oh, isn't it cute? Isn't it gorgeous? I'm like, that's your import? Thanks for that. Like,
but if we could have Paris Hilton on the show, we'd take it, right? Like, seriously. Yeah, like, absolutely. They would just have been going, wow, this is to land someone.
I get it.
If you're listening, Paris Hilton, he takes it all back, every word of it.
No. I understand why she was on the show, but it just felt really hollow.
You can talk about anything that you think's cute.
Anyway.
That money purse. The first thing, what was that worth in the end?
It was like priceless.
It was like worth millions, right?
Priceless.
And the whole mouth thing, was a big... I didn't find... It was crazy, like the colour green in the Lego, that all this discussion about, you know, the mouth, does it have a mouth? You know, the uproar when she finally, the Hello Kitty had a mouth. And then, like, weird stuff when Hello Kitty got a pet cat.
Yeah.
And it's like... Yeah, I'm just like, whoa, this is strange, but oddly it made sense.
Goofy and Pluto.
Yeah, exactly the same thing. But the mouth to me always seemed like, well, if you're going to animate it, when she's talking, there's a mouth, and when she's resting, there's no mouth. That's I saw it as that, and that was it. I didn't see any big controversy.
And maybe that's a cultural thing, that as far as a change like that is really insignificant to us here in the Western side of things. But yeah, it did seem. Overplayed,
but someone implied that literally the character did not have a physical mouth, and I thought that's just weird. Why would you do that?
Well, if you're making it from scratch, you make the rules, I guess. Like, I don't know. Yeah. It just
Okay. All right. On that, we will end this segment and move into the next topic.
Vintage Toyline Retrospective.
Right, now we are over to our toy line retrospective. This was a fan request by Casey Hancock. He said that we don't cover enough 90s toys, and how about the Zoids toy line? So, unfortunately for us, none of us actually collect Zoids, but I took it upon myself to, shout out, hey guys, let's really, take this to heart, and I'll do a bit of research, and I'll, I'll do the background work on it, and let's have a shout out and learn some interesting things about the Zoids toy line. So here it is, Casey. The Zoids is a science fiction media franchise created by Takara, Tommy, that feature giant robots or mechas called Zoids. A Zoid is essentially a large mechanical animal with designs being based on animals such as tigers, lions, or various dinosaurs. The franchise started with a model kit based toy line and includes several main anime TV series, as well as a wide selection of video games and manga products. There have been a number of different Zoid lines over the years, both in Japan and other countries. Between these lines, there are over 200 different designs that have been released, some several times over. Several companies outside of Takara Tomy have produced Zoid kits. This has led to Zoids being made as die-cast figures, highly detailed posing kits, smaller action figures, and even PVC figures. So, winding it back, the predecessors to Zoids was released in 1982. The Mecha Bionicle was technically not a Zoids line, but is counted as such by collectors, as it consisted of three models that would later be released as the three Zoids. The Garius, the Elephantus, and the Glidior. I butchered those names. The line was not really successful and was quickly dropped by Tomy. Then Tomy sold the Mecha Bionica line in the United States and Europe in late 1982. So a very similar storyline to the Transformers universe. Mm. Under the name Zoids, the line was far more successful than Mecha Bionica, which led Tomy to reintroduce the line in Japan under the new name. Zoids toys were actually quite clever model kits, which don't require any glue to assemble. the first OAR, original American release, wave of kits included a clockwork-type mechanism to move, which might allow the model to walk, arms to move, or even flapping wings. Later waves of the larger kits then changed to relying on battery for power to move the kits, but also then opened up the gateway to lights and sometimes sounds. Smaller kits still relied on the clockwork wind-up mechanism. As any good stories told, these Zoids were actually mechanical warrior war machines split up by two factions, the Red Mutants versus the Blue Guardians. The model kits were packed in boxes, but the really neat aspect was they actually had photos of the kits on the packaging in a really cool outdoor setting, very fitting to the storyline and eye-catching to consumers. This initial run continued till around 1990.
Because the other line that did this, and it was the Japanese repackaging or redistribution of the line, was in Dino Riders, where they took the photographs. So similar sort of in with the setting and, and really nice photography. Mm. It's in that vein, is
very,
that what we're
very
seeing?
Very, very much so, definitely. Mm. That's what reminded me, seeing these box art and stuff. And they're truly, you know, breathtaking, like... Yeah, for photos from that time, it's, yeah. So after initial run in the 80s, these model kits had numerous short-lived releases from many countries, including Kenner, trying to breathe new life into the brand and capture new and old fans alike. In 1999, Tommy relaunched the Zoids line in Japan in a huge way. Initially, the line consisted of recolored re-releases of older Zoids, but Tommy quickly began producing new Zoids designs. With the backing of a cartoon, Zoids was now a recognized name to a new generation of fans all over the world. But along with the relaunch of the Zoids line, Tommy also launched a line known as Customized Parts, or simply CP. The line consisted of additional weapons and equipment that could be added onto Zoids models. The line was a mixture of new parts and reissues of parts originally included in various models. This new relaunch line of models was discontinued in 2004, and the customizer parts lasted until 2002. Now, from mid-2000s, the Zoids models have never really stopped being manufactured over the years. They have numerous sublines and companies all releasing their own takes on the mechs. Some of these companies have taken the opportunity to celebrate milestone years like the 25th anniversary line.
Mm. They're really cool. We've got a store here in Adelaide called Shin Tokyo, and they get a lot of the Japanese product, Masterpiece, and a lot of manga comics. And I went down there to just have a bit of a look, and sure enough, there was a section of these model kits on Zoids. And they're really impressive. I'm amazed, one, that they're model kits that don't need glue. That's just so cool.
Yeah. Until this research, I always assumed they had glue. Yeah. I just assumed. Yeah. Basing that off no pre-existing knowledge. I
most
assumed.
Model kits do.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
That's a turn-off for me because I'm crap with glue.
Yeah.
But then the fact that they're building in mechanisms and potentially battery-operated, that's really cool. And these designs look so intricate.
Yes.
The detail on them, the mechanical nature, it really gives you that these are war machines, dangerous, ferocious machines with a lot of detail, nice color choices. So really impressive visually.
Yeah.
Really cool.
Definitely. They also have a magnitude of video game releases tying into the Zoids property. Way, way, way too many to list here. And spanning all formats from arcade, PC, mobile, and even home console versions. But one form of media that Zoids doesn't seem to have much history in is actually in the comic book format.
Mm.
So the one comic book format that I could found was from the UK Zoids comics that were published in the early 1980s. A Zoids tie-in strip was actually published in the Marvel UK title Secret Wars, of all things. On the backs of this, it gained its own weekly title, Spider-Man and Zoids. So there's a crossover, Frank, I want to see in your collection soon.
All right, done.
It was created to go along with the UK and subsequently Australian release of model kits. The comic is notable for featuring early work by none other than Grant Morrison,
nice.
Hmm.
including the epic and apocalyptic Black Zoid storyline. So Black Symbiote Spider-Man, Black Zoids. Mate, there's another toy line to get suckered into.
All right.
Now, I apologize that I've not covered any of the Japanese manga from the Zoids franchise, as I did not find any titles listed, and especially none that I could see that were English translated titles in my research. So I apologize in advance if... And let us know. Let us know if there's a big manga, property fan base out there that capture these comic books. All right, now over to the anime. So Zoids Chaotic Century was the first Zoids series to air. It ran for an impressive 67 episodes. It initially aired in early 1999 and ran until the end of 2000. Zoids New Century, or also known as Zoids Zero, was the second series and ran for 35 episodes. It ran during 2001. Zoids Fusers was the third series. It comprised of 26 episodes and ran during 2003. Zoids Wild is an upcoming series announced in February 2018. Little has been announced about the series, but it is notable that the characters are depicted riding on top of Zoids rather than within an enclosed cockpit, as in previous Zoids media. The first episode is due for it to be released in early July 2018, so not long. No, I think we should check it out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sure. And comment on it once we've seen it. So.
Yeah, but that was sorry to interrupt for a second, but that was going to be my question. Are these autonomous, like Transformer-style robots, or are they more Voltron-ish, they have pilots in
them?
They
don't transform, but they do have pilots, yes.
Right,
But so I suppose this new series, it's like in the past, where the eyes would be is like a little visor shield.
Okay.
And that's where the pilot would... traditionally sit in the animated cartoons, but they're now saying in this new Wild cartoon
they're riding
on top, so there's no, they're not in them, so the mechs potentially have a mind of their own, or this is some all speculation sort of link. We'll find out more.
So do the model kits actually have the little like pilots with them?
I don't know.
Not sure.
To be honest.
Okay.
I couldn't tell you. I don't know if they're like those Micronaut. Pre-transformed Diaclone. I don't know if they're like Diaclone. Type things, but I wouldn't be surprised if they did have little characters that you could put in there, but my research didn't go that deep, I'm afraid, cool. So apologies.
That's all right.
Rounding it out, with the announcement of this new anime, it is rumoured that there will be a new Zoids toy line to coincide it, so yippee-yay-yay. And also some exciting games too. No real release dates on the games, but they are supposed to have a basic mobile game as well as one for the Nintendo Switch. Good luck to any Zoids fan. Sounds like there's a plethora of stuff to collect out there for Zoids. Yeah. So I'm surprised, honestly, that I haven't got anything in my collection, because doing this research had me pretty hyped to buy a model kit.
Yeah, I did want to buy one. I didn't check the price on them. They looked expensive. Yeah. So, but I wanted to buy one so we could just build one and sort of see what it was like. But I know, shout out to Steven Ludus, who is part of SO2 Collectors, who's a big Zoids fan. And he'll often post, all right, time to sit down and build one of these bad boys. And then you'll sort of see him when he's finished it. But super, super impressive. Yeah. I'm just blown away by, again, Japanese engineering and ingenuity to have these model kits that you can just snap together.
So very, hopefully very we did that Zoids retrospective justice, Casey. So hopefully that we ticked all the boxes. Looking forward to July when the new anime cartoon comes out. And, I'd love to hear back from you of what you think of this new cartoon and things. And, if it's you being a big Zoids fan, obviously, if it ticks all your boxes, or if you're really excited about this and, it wins you over. Or if, on the flip side, I preferred the original run back in 2000 or something. You might think that you don't like the idea of the pilots not piloting the Zoids or... I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, well, he's called it out as a 90s toy line, so it sounds like he's been a fan for a long time. Yeah. It'd be interesting to hear if he's still on board or, migrated away.
There is, doing my research, there are so many kits out there. Like, it's just eye-boggling how many kits and variations and companies and everything. Like, it seems like a massive property that everyone's tried to make a few dollars on and release their own variations of the Zoids property.
Sounds like a completist nightmare,
you'd have to almost select, this is the run I'm going to go for. or just completely cherry pick. I don't think there'd be too. I mean, there probably is, but I don't think there'd be too many completists out there with the plethora of toy releases from this property.
Cool. Interestingly, I know Casey sort of shouted out that we're probably a bit stuck in the 80s here on this show, and that's cool. You know, we want to be as diverse as
guilty
we can.
Guilty as charged.
Yeah. But there were, in his email, there are a few other... Do you have it there? Casey's email?
Sorry.
But he was like, you know, shout out to some other properties of the 90s, like Super Soakers. And that's something I can really relate to. I love Super Soakers
when I was
a kid. Like, I think we've briefly touched on this in past episodes, but it's like, what was it? Super 30. Super Soaker 40. Super Soaker 50! And that was just, for me, like, Australia here, I can't do Celsius to Fahrenheit conversions. But here in Adelaide, we're a very dry climate. And in Celsius, we can get days of 42, 43, 44, which is pushing well over and above 100 degrees Fahrenheit.
Correct.
Right? So it's it gets hot. So water pistols are a big one. I have this vivid memory of an ad on TV, the Super Soaker I always wanted. It was like you would shoot at it, but that you could change the direction of the nozzle without moving the gun. It's like the biggest gimmick in the world because, like, why can't you do this? But he was like shooting people around the corner and like he was taking out like hordes of these people and they're just like getting knocked over. But yeah, there were some Super Soakers where you'd strap them onto your back and you'd have tanks and all that sort of thing. So that was really cool.
Yeah. And Super Soakers continues today under the Nerf brand. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess, Nerf you can play in any weather conditions, rain, hail or shine. It doesn't need to be 40 degrees Celsius outside. But yeah, look, '90s as well, particularly early 90s.
Did some of the movie lines from the 90s. Things like, I reckon we've touched on Waterworld on here, Dick Tracy, obviously. So we've done some of the movie lines from the 90s, I reckon, on Toy Power.
Yeah, and Batman when we've talked to...
Definitely.
The Dark Knight collection and Batman animated series and that sort of thing. Yeah, I certainly was still collecting toys in the early 90s.
Guilty's Chest.
Yeah.
Toxic Crusaders, Hook, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles was still going strong for us. In fact, it started in Australia in 1990, so.
Yeah. What's, anyone know much about Beyblades? I know that was one thing coming out of Mega Toy Swap Meet, that it was sort of almost like there was the next generation of 90s toys that were now becoming quite collectible, so... We've talked about Power Rangers, and we know that that's well entrenched now in the sort of...
For me, I know they're different properties, but Pokemon, Digimon, Beyblades, all that sort of... They all roll into one. Agreed.
But I think they're all starting to come regenerate. Around.
Yeah, because those kids who it hit big with, they're now, you know, got their own jobs and stuff, and they're us 20 years ago kind of thing. Where
Bakudan? Bakudan? Those balls that transform... Is that Bakudan?
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
I get lost in all the names.
Shout out to the fact that they've all got pretty decent long running cartoons and things, and also their toys seem to be plentiful on of the time on the toy shelves. Like,
absolutely.
I mean, it's all common names to me because I've
seen them around.
Seen them.
They're
in the
household names for that reason because they were available here.
Never interested in buying anything from those properties, but I've definitely seen them on the shelves and such.
Yeah. And that's one thing I think, going back to Zoids, that's what I think they did really well, is for every run of toys, there was a computer game of some sort, there was a show to go with. Yeah. Like,
well, they didn't
really...
actually really get into the shows till around 2000. So, that was a bit of an eye-opener. And I couldn't find any information on Japanese shows or anything.
Yeah.
So, I think their enormous burst to the younger generation that didn't grow up in the 80s and 90s was that 2000 era cartoon. I remember watching that cartoon. I wasn't overly interested in it, but I do remember seeing it as part of the larger block of cartoon.
Was it animated or CGI?
It was animated.
Yeah, okay.
No. Oh, I think there was a little bit of both, to be honest.
Right, yeah.
Because there was about three different iterations through the course of three or 4 years.
Yeah.
So I didn't look into that deep, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was a bit of both. Or, you know, that Voltron-ness where it's got cartoon and then it changes into CG for that big one fight scene.
2.5D, whatever they do. Batman Ninja was a bit like that. Very good. All right. On that note, massive thank you to Ben for researching Zoids. You did a really good job. And I've learned something.
You smashed it as usual, Ben.
And that's what we like to do here on Toy Power, is learn about these properties that maybe, you know, we didn't get into or sort of missed us from a generational point of view. So it's really good to try and bring that to the forefront of the show. Absolutely. For change. So well done.
Thank you, Casey, for drawing our attention to it as well, because, you know, sometimes you can get a little bit blinkered with the properties that you're into,
for sure.
and it helps take a larger view sometimes. So please, anyone out there listening, if you've got a toy line, you know, we're open to suggestions and ideas. You know, send us a message.
Yeah. And Casey, apparently a friend of Charles McFall. So nice to know that those exist. So,
mic drop.
He doesn't listen to this show.
No. Oh, we love Charles.
We do.
You should have seen the grief I copped when I, like, at, you know, early days. I'm like, I really love Charles. Like, Charles is my favorite, you know, on the show. And it was just like, you should have seen Paul and Chris just go at me. It was like,
nice.
And then I learned.
You were seen as a traitor.
On that note, huge thank you for tuning in to another episode of Toy Power. It is absolutely great to have your company again. And a massive shout out to our Patreons, Lux Toy Collector, Jose Gonzalez, Brett G, and Chris Wisdom. On that note, we will see you around the toy aisles.
Thank you, one and all, and until next time, good journey.
You can find the Toy Power team at all the usual online places. Facebook.com/Toy Power Podcast, at Toy Power Podcast on both Twitter and Instagram, or have your say and email us, toypowerpodcast@gmail.com. Subscribe to the show on both iTunes and Stitcher, and please leave us a review. Otherwise, we just assume we're awesome.
We are a proud member of the Giant Size Team Up Network. Check out all the awesome shows on this awesome network full of okay people. Want to learn more? Go to GiantSizeTeamUp.com, where you can find us and a whole lot more awesome shows. Well, they're not more awesome than us, but... yeah.